Hello and welcome to Local Matters. I'm Caroline Moore, and today I'm chatting with local sculptor, furniture maker, and fabricator David Fricke.
Hello.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Now, David, before we dive into your artistry, where are you from?
I was originally, born in Maine, but I was raised outside of Memphis, Tennessee. Lived here for about 16 years before moving back up north for school.
Are your parents from Maine?
Oh, they're kind of from all over.
Okay.
We're very much a non-regionally specific family.
Got it. Yeah. So you were kind of transplants in West Tennessee.
Yep,
pretty
much.
Which has a very rich, distinct culture.
Absolutely.
Were you always artistic as a child?
I'd say maybe yes, but mostly just because I was so disinterested in everything else. I had a very artistic, creative upbringing. My family was really into the arts, very theater involved, a lot of music and that kind of thing. I had wanted to be a documentary photographer, though. Not super artistic, more of just observational, but
why photography?
Well, my father had been a photographer back in the 60s and 70s through kind of the early 80s, doing newspaper work up in New York, kind of documenting cultural upheaval back in that time, and I was always kind of fascinated by it. And so when I was 12, he asked me whether or not I wanted a bow or a camera, and I chose camera. And so he helped me build a darkroom, and I was processing my own film and printing all the way through high school and decided to go to college for it. And that became an entirely different world. But
it's great that you had a family that supported your artistry.
Yeah.
Did you take a lot of art classes in school? Were you taking classes extracurricularly?
No, actually, I'm kind of embarrassed about that one. I had applied for art school in like the fall of my senior year of high school because I knew I wanted to be a photographer. That was what life was all about. I was one of those nerds that carried a camera around everywhere and took photos of all of his friends and all that. But I realized that, wait, I haven't even taken Art 1. So I took I took Art 1 my second semester senior year of high school. And so I went into art school pretty blind. Did not enjoy drawing. Didn't really understand sculpture. I think at that point too, I was a little bit kind of hesitant about it. I kind of put documentary work on this pedestal, and art is silly and that kind of thing.
Right. That happens when you're young. So serious when you're young.
Yeah.
Everything is so intense.
Yeah. Also, so critical about it. I mean, there's especially growing up in sort of a public school system, if you don't fall in with the right crowd immediately, you kind of don't know how to feel about certain things. And mm-hmm. I think art was definitely one of those complicated issues for a youth, to try and wrap their head around.
Which school did you apply to?
I had applied to, I was interested in RIT for their photography program. I got into Pratt in Brooklyn. I was interested in RISD, Portland School of Design, or Portland College of Art.
Those are all very good schools.
I was pretty excited about it, but I had fallen in love with Boston just as a city. And I found the Art Institute of Boston through Lesley University, which is now LUCAD. Lesley University College of Art and Design. So I got in with them, but it was once again like a very art focused photography program. So it was largely about sort of alternative processes, very kind of painterly photography, that kind of thing. And I didn't really feel like there was space for me, and I started to have kind of worse and worse experiences there. So I like to say I fired them after 3 years.
I like that. Seize control.
Yeah.
I fired you.
Th- that kind of sent me down a totally different path, though. So it was on the whole, the best decision. I'm pretty sure my parents were trying to do backflips when I told them that I was planning on dropping out of school. And then through odd happenstance, ended up working as a carpenter and realized that I really loved the process of making, and I kind of had a knack for different methods of construction, and I loved power tools, and that was something that was, you know, both my parents were, you know, hard workers, and my mother was a seamstress, and you know, my father
Mine
did all this.
Too.
Hey,
I'm Caroline Moore, and today I'm chatting with local sculptor, furniture maker, and fabricator David Fricke. He just talked about how he was into photography, but went away from that, and then you got into doing hands-on things like carpentry. Did you just teach yourself? How do you learn?
No, it was kind of strange. One year I was kind of trapped in Boston for Christmas, couldn't go home, and all of my friends had left for family times and everything, and I got invited over to some sort of Hanukkah get together, and met some wonderful people, and through a wonderful person ended up getting a job with her father as a carpenter, cabinet maker's apprentice, and I just fell in love with hands-on work. It all made sense for some reason. All of a sudden, math was relevant in a way that I had never really appreciated, and I feel like everything that I was kind of hesitant about but respected a lot, you know, growing up, suddenly just made sense. And at some point, a friend of mine from photo school had transferred over to Massachusetts College of Art and Design for glass blowing, and he needed an assistant in the shop. And so I was working carpentry during the day and then going over and, you know, blowing glass in the evenings.
Casual?
Yeah, you know, as you do.
How did you learn to blow glass? I feel like you have a new talent every other day.
Well, it was all through my friend Andrew McCormick. He just sort of took me in, and because he just needed help while he was in school. He didn't have a blow partner at the time that could match up with his schedule, and so I assisted him for a year, and then the following year he, you know, had an assistant at the school, but I kept coming in, and I started making, you know, tools through the carpentry shop I was working in. I had access to all these tools, so I was making all the wooden tools for the glass shop, you know, paddles and benches and things like that, and so they allowed me to kind of just keep coming in, even though I wasn't a student, I wasn't affiliated. Eventually, they made me a glass shop monitor, even though I was not experienced enough for that. I had just been around helping people enough. So after a few years of doing that, I decided to go back to school. And so I wanted to be a better woodworker, but I really liked Mass Art for the facilities and the environment. And you know, at the same time, I was there's a really wonderful sort of community art center in Jamaica Plains, which is a borough of Boston, called the Elliott School, which has been around since the 1600s. I think it was endowed in like 1690 and has gone through all these different transformations since then. And it's still in the same building it's been in since the 1820s. It's just such a cool spot.
Cool.
Great facilities and wonderful teachers, but I was teaching darkroom photography there, assisting people in the glass shop, and, you know, working carpentry on the side, and then starting to go back to school.
I feel like you're a very quick learner.
That's my only saving grace, because outside of that, I'm kind of a moron.
I have the opposite problem. It takes me forever to get something.
I don't say that I understand it, but somehow the hands figure it out. The brain never gets it. But
do you ever feel like you have imposter syndrome?
Oh, all of the time.
Since you never officially or formally learned something, even though you can do it very well.
I'm sitting here talking on the radio right now. Yes, I have imposter syndrome.
I feel the same way.
Yeah. No, it's. I mean, it's a lot, and it all happens, you know, relatively quickly. I've been very lucky to find myself in positions where I can, you know, I'm kind of forced to learn new skills very, very quickly. I enjoy that kind of stress. Like I enjoy that kind of, you know, pressure. I'm definitely like a last minute paper kind of a person.
Oh yeah. If there's no deadline, I'm not doing it.
Oh yeah. No, even if there is a deadline, I'm going to wait until the last possible minute, because that's when, you know, yeah, that passion really comes out.
That's when the pressure's on. Would you describe yourself as a perfectionist? Because I feel like perfectionists rarely jump into things because they're scared they're going to do it wrong.
I want things to be right. And I want to do things to the best of my ability. And I will definitely always see the things that I did not do in a way that I even if it's fine, even if it's fine and nobody else will ever see it, that mm-hmm. one little thing can ruin it for me for the rest of the time. And I will fixate on it. I've got projects like that to this day.
And you can still see the little mistake.
Yep. And no one else will see it unless I point it out. And even then, they're like, I don't understand what you're talking about. It's like, well, really, it was a problem with what I did in the process. I mean, it's honestly fine. But, I know that I could have done A, B, and C differently. But that's, I mean, that's all part of the learning process. So I think I might not be I would say that I'm not a perfectionist. Not because, and not in a way that, you know, causes my work to somehow be of lesser quality, but just because I do like to take risks, and I like to take on large-scale projects, some of which require skill sets that I haven't developed yet. And I think I feel most confident in positions where they're sort of an extreme end of the learning spectrum. I think that's sitting down and understanding something is hard. Just sitting down and doing things.
Just doing it yourself.
Yeah, that feels good. Yeah.
More with David Fricke after the break.
What's so important about shopping with locally owned businesses?
When you shop local, your hard-earned dollars stay here in the community, helping to benefit your friends and neighbors, local schools, roads, and all aspects of community life.
But what happens to my money if I spend it online or at a national chain store?
In most cases, the profits go far away, out of state, corporate headquarters, or even overseas.
It doesn't take any extra effort to shop local. OfficeMart on South Jefferson and Cookeville is your locally owned office furniture and supply store. For over 35 years, they've been proud to serve businesses in the Upper Cumberland with quality and value. You get real customer service, too. And unlike shopping online, you can actually see and try out the large inventory of office furniture in their showroom. And when it's delivered, it's not a box on your step. They're glad to install and set up everything. OfficeMart. There's no other locally owned office store in the region. South Jefferson Avenue across from Hardee's. Shop local at OfficeMart.
Hello and welcome back to Local Matters. I'm Caroline Moore, and today I'm chatting with local sculptor, furniture maker, and fabricator David Fricke.
Hello.
Before the break, you talked about going back to school. So what did your degree end up being in?
It ended up being a BFA in fine arts, focusing in sculpture. Sculpture department was kind of different from everything else because it was everything else. So you could have your focus in fibers or ceramics or metals or anything like that. Sculpture was just sort of like a meh bucket of mush of all of that.
What kind of sculpting did you train in specifically, or do you have to train in all of it?
You don't have to train in all of it. You can kind of do whatever you want. I mean, there were students there that their main work was all made out of spray foam and random things like that.
Cool.
But yeah, it was actually really neat. But I went there because I wanted to be a better woodworker. But, you know, spending years working in a carpentry shop where, like, kind of anything goes, just people just throwing things through table saws and hoping for the best. There were pretty, you know, stringent regulations on how to use the wood shop, and I got really nervous about that. I kind of like skipped over the qualifying class, the projects in wood class. I got kind of tested out of that because of previous experience. And since I didn't have that, anytime I went to go work in the woodshop, they're like, oh, did you take projects in wood? And I was like, no, I tested out that. Like, well, we don't know what you know, so you can't use this tool. So I...
Great.
Yeah, it was really handy. I took a welding class and, you know, had some friends that kind of picked me out of that class and... dragged me into the iron casting world. So I got really into foundry work and specifically cast iron. And there's such an amazing kind of community throughout the nation in cast iron. It's I've been kind of involved in that whole community for a long time now.
Did you think you were going to end up staying in Boston and stay with that community at art school, or were you always planning to go somewhere else?
Well, I don't think I ever really had a plan. I'm not good at planning ahead, but...
That's a way to live life, though. You never know what's going to happen.
Yeah, it's a lot more fun that way.
Yeah.
Fly by the seat of your pants. Drop trout, set sail. Growing up in Tennessee, I had my mother would put on these arts festivals in Collierville, Tennessee, and the Mulberry Festival, and Jack Stoddart used to come out and bring his photography, and I used to bring him my photography when I was like really little, and he'd give me advice and critiques, and then we'd trade work. And then when I was in high school, I used to drive out here to his farm outside of town.
Hippie Jacks.
And kept kind of working with him on all that. He wrote my recommendation to go to college.
Wow.
So then I kept coming down for all the festivals, because it was just a lot of fun. And we would talk every single, festival about starting some sort of a sculptural community, building cabins, having these sort of artistic and musical retreats for people. And so we built this whole plan for me to move down. And he said, well, we're going to need more people than just you. So my partner Bree moved down, who owns the Silver Fern. She's a fantastic metalsmith and artist, and works a lot in the community. As well as Emma Levitz, who's a stone carver here in town, also does a lot in the community, very active.
Very talented.
And another friend of ours who has since moved on and is doing great things out in North Carolina. But all four of us moved down, and then, things happened, and as most cultural residencies go, they fell through.
Okay. Was that hard to stomach?
Oh, very much so.
That's your whole plan for coming here, and then you're just in the middle of nowhere in Tennessee.
It was a little bit frightening. It was a little bit frightening, and it was kind of hard for all of us at first. But we, very quickly learned that Cookeville was a really wonderful space with a lot of really great people, a lot of positive development going on in town. I mean, everywhere there's a lot of negative development. There's a balance everywhere. So, take the good with the bad. But the positive development in the area, as far as a focus on the arts and culture, it seemed to be like a really wonderful time to have just sort of landed here. And so we kind of quickly became a part of all of that, and it was really nice to be accepted by everyone, kind of being an out-of-stater and everything. And kids are saying blessed, I guess.
Hashtag blessed.
That's the one. That's the one.
Cookeville does have a very impressive art scene.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Especially for a region our size. So how did you get involved with the art scene here? I know there's Art Round Tennessee and the Cookeville Art Studio. How did you just dive in?
Well, I think it had a lot to do with Art Round Tennessee. you know, we had figured, oh, we'll do Art Prowl. You know, we live 45 minutes away on the side of a mountain. We might as well do something in town.
And Crawford, right?
Yep, that's the one. And it was kind of a turning point. We just were able to, you know, get in touch and learn more about the community and, you know, other local artists like Marilee Hall and Brad Sells. And I ended up working with Brad Sells for about 4 years, and we're currently kind of working jointly on a, you know, massive sculpture going in town, which is exciting.
Oh, cool. What's the sculpture?
Oh, I don't want to talk about it too much. It's still
in
the...
It's a surprise.
It's a surprise. There'll be candles. It'll be great. It's a large cast bronze piece that's going to end up going into Dogwood Park.
Cool.
So that's been in the works for almost a year now. I'm in the process of the endlessly enjoyably tedious process of foundry work, which is something that I really, really love, but it's maddening.
Can you define what foundry is?
Sure. So, most people are familiar with blacksmithing and stuff like that. That's, you know, forge work. Foundry is any time that you're actually melting that metal and pouring it into molds. So instead of, you know, using a hammer to beat something into shape, you're making it liquid and, you know, pouring it into a form.
And you do this in your own shop, right?
Yep. But I've done work through Tennessee Tech's Engineering Foundry. They're wonderful. Dr. Vondra has done, you know, great work with all of that. The cast iron community, once again, nationally meets every 2 years down at Sloss Furnaces in Birmingham, Alabama. So I've got the bench over by the depot with the wheel on the front of it, my chaise barrow.
I love that.
But I cast that wheel down there.
Cool.
Cast iron requires a different furnace that I just can't really run up here.
I've laid down on that. Like, it's very comfortable.
Likewise, I've slept on that in the shop when I've been working overnight on it.
My gosh. More with David Fricke right after the break. Hello and welcome back to Local Matters. I'm Caroline Moore, and today I'm chatting with local sculptor, furniture maker, and fabricator David Fricke. David, what is your typical day like? Do you go to the shop?
Yeah. I'm very lucky that my shop is actually right outside our house. So I get up bright and early in the morning and feed the cats and make my coffee and then wander outside and spend a solid half an hour just staring at all the things that I should probably be working on.
It's probably overwhelming when you're working on things that are very large in size.
Yeah.
So your shop is massive.
I've seen it.
Well, to me, it's like a warehouse.
Well, it's two garages, essentially.
Well, to me, that's big.
It's a lot more than I've ever had, and I'm very thankful for it. I just wish I had a bigger garage door.
Where do you get your materials? How do you even start working on a sculpture? Can you walk us through that process?
Sure. So I guess it really depends on, you know, what the project is. Because I don't like to make things out of one specific material. There are artists that work strictly in bronze or strictly in clay, and I really enjoy the combination of different materials, especially, you know, wood and metal are kind of the most accessible. Anytime that I can add glass to that, I really get to have fun. And then it also depends on whether or not it's a fabrication process or a foundry process. So I guess everything kind of begins with a lot of measuring,
which is math.
I love math. I'm kind of I'm an uneducated math nerd. So it's like I don't know enough about it to really sound good. I just think it's hot.
Well, when you're actually using math and applying it to things like sculpting or even cooking, it actually is fun.
Yeah.
It's just not fun in school when you just have a pen and paper and you're talking about an axis that you're never going to see.
Yeah. Like, I don't understand why when they said, you know, you'll be using math for the rest of your life, they didn't add on, and that's cool.
Yeah.
If we had only known that it was cool before, then, I mean, we'd all be nerds. It'd be great. But yeah, I do a lot of layout for more of my fabrication pieces. I use an MDF table instead of a steel table, which is kind of, you know, not the coolest, but it's really great for, laying out fabricated pieces. If it's the foundry process, then, it's a lot of mold making, and a lot of parts making out of wax, and you know, then there's a lot of mold making of that, and basically the foundry process is just mold making after mold making after mold making. You start with rubber molds, move to plaster molds of the rubber molds, and then you cast things into the rubber molds, and then you take those out and you make another mold of those out of a ceramic shell, and then you melt out the wax from that and pour stuff into it, and then you remove everything from that mold. You're basically making the sculpture three times over.
There's so much preparation that goes into this.
It is an eight-phase, state of constant tedium, but it's also a lot of fun. It's like relaxingly, maddeningly both, exhausting.
What are some of the works that people might recognize around town, or what are things that you've done?
Let's see. The first piece I did in town was out on the patio at Father Tom's. So there, if you've ever been out there, all the cast aluminum writing that's out there with the glass components and
the
steel frames. That was a lot of fun. I do a lot of writing in most all of my work from undergrad and thereafter. I'd like to write a lot of music and include a lot of text in the piece that I make. And every piece needs its own font, because it would be rude to just reuse the same font over and over again. So everything gets its own type design and all of that. So just adding more steps onto it for fun.
And you do music as well.
Yeah.
One more talent to add to your resume.
I wouldn't call it a talent, but, it's definitely a good time. But I've got, if you ever go out to Hicks Farm Brewery, the gate out front.
It's cool.
Oh, thanks.
Y'all got to go look at the gate by Hicks, or in the front of Hicks Brewery. It's right across the street from Ralph's Donuts. You've probably seen it. It's probably my favorite.
Oh, shucks.
Now, when people want a sculpture from you, do they just email you? How do you connect with people? How do you even build a client base, especially in a place you're not from?
Well, right now it's largely just been word of mouth. And that's worked for me so far. I'm very bad at social media. I feel like anything digital is so abstract in my mind, I can't quite wrap my head around making the time to just do it. But I'm working on a website. I've got an Instagram, which is at Fricky the Younger, F-R-I-C-K-E, the Younger. That's pretty much all I've got right now. But everything's just been word of mouth. And there's such a strong community that I've been, very lucky to just sort of have consistent work.
I'm Caroline Moore, and today I'm chatting with local sculptor, furniture maker, and fabricator, David Fricky. How long do these projects take you? Like the fence, or like the gate in front of Hicks Brewery, how long did that take to make?
That was a special case. When the usually projects that I take on tend to take depending on what they are and how involved the process is, it could take like a month to 6 months. This current foundry project I've got going on is going to take by the end of it probably 8 to 10 full months for me. The gate, I kind of got it approved, but really wanted to get it installed by Art Prowl last year. So I got that done in 3 weeks.
Wow.
was a mad dash and totally worth it, but definitely slept for a long time after that.
I was about to say, you probably did not sleep very much.
No.
Wow. That is very impressive to do that in 3 weeks. So when you're working on these multiple projects, or do you work on multiple projects, or are you just fixated on the one thing for months?
I mostly get fixated on one thing. And that's usually because most of the things I work on are multiple steps anyway. So I've got a wood shop and I've got a metal shop. And so like making a batch of tables for Hicks Farm, that was, you know, working on 10 tables at once that all require, a bunch of lamination in the wood shop and a bunch of finishing in the wood shop while simultaneously welding all of the bases together in the other shop and finishing all of that. So I'm kind of trying to work my time between, you know, setting times for different, urethanes with, you know, also having to do all the welding and grinding and, you know, cleaning and finishing work in the other shop. So, since everything's kind of multifaceted, I kind of can't bounce between projects. Because I'm already kind of bouncing between projects.
Right. There's already a million things going on with one.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you're done with a project, do you feel relieved or are you just thinking on to the next?
I think it's kind of a combination of everything. I think by the end of any project, I'm very ready for it to be done.
You've only been staring at it for 10 months.
Oh, yeah.
I can imagine you'd be pretty sick of it.
And you know, once again, you know, talking about, you know, kind of procrastination and, you know, if you know, being under the gun is kind of a wonderful motivator and in an almost exciting way. Mm-hmm. Like there's this rush of adrenaline of, you know, trying to get a project done. But that also comes with its own degree of, mild insanity. And I think that adds to it adds to the excitement. You know, it becomes like, you know, you're starring in your own kind of movie where nothing's going wrong necessarily, but you've got so much happening that you're trying to keep track of that you're just rushing between everything, and I'm always excited at the completion. I'm always ready to be done and ready to move on, but there's always a sense of, it's almost like you walk out of the shop and, you know, you pat it on its head and say, good job, boy, and then
wave goodbye.
Yeah, and then wander off into the sunset, and then, you know, wander out of the sunset the next morning and go crazy again. You know, it's fun.
Is there anything that you've dreamed of making or you just hope somebody commissions? Listeners?
I've got so many things like that, and most of them are absolutely absurd. I like to make big, dumb, heavy things. I'm no gallery artist. Nobody ever really wants to buy what I make. They kind of just commission me to make things, so it's kind of hard to, you know, make exactly what I want all the time. But I've got a myriad of horrible and wonderful ideas, I guess.
Well, if y'all have an idea for David, how can they contact you? How can the listeners find you online or contact you if they're interested?
I think the best way would be probably through my Instagram. And if you can find me on my Instagram, then you'll be notified once my website's done. one of those endless process things. Hopefully that will be done within the year.
So. And we will have this uploaded online as well, so you can always come back and revisit it. Thank you all so much for listening. Thank you, David, for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
It was an absolute pleasure.
Likewise.
Cheers.